Hey there, Journey Into fans. This is Marshall Latham preempting my own podcast once again. I just wanted to give a huge shout out to Keith Teklitz, who has edited many of these episodes and edited this one as well. And this time he had to put in even more effort because, unfortunately, like has happened to many of us, in the editing process, he lost a lot of the work that he had done. And that's so frustrating. It makes it so much harder to go through that process again for the same material that you've already done. And so I truly do appreciate Keith and his efforts. It is the most grueling part of podcasting, and it often goes unnoticed. So I just wanted to once again thank Keith for helping me out with this podcast. And hopefully he'll be able to do it again in the future. Now on to the show. Welcome to another Strewn Along the Path episode here on the Journey Into podcast. And this is another Netflix queue episode. I'm getting caught up on these. And I don't know, it's just something for me, just a vehicle, I guess, for me to talk to you guys about something rather than just rambling on about my own life or little things that are going on. This provides me with something to talk about. It provides me with a platform, a format, whatever you want to say, just to get stuff out on the podcast. Today I'm going to talk about October movies. I'm going to talk about things that I watched in October in 2017. And who knows when this is going to come out. Maybe it'll be October 2018 when I finally get this episode out. Who knows? Every year I've been trying to, in October, either read a scary book or get movies on Netflix for us to watch as a family, especially if my kids are involved. You know, I'm going to be pretty particular about what I watch. And I don't watch the types of movies that I did when I was a kid. I just, you know, watched anything and everything. Now I'm a little bit more picky. Anyway, so this year I kind of went classic with my selections for October Netflix stories or movies. All right, so what did I rent from Netflix in October 2017? Well, like I said, I went with the classics. Over the years, I've watched several of the Roger Corman, Edgar Allan Poe movies that are out there. And it's always interesting because it can be like an original story that brings several elements of different Edgar Allan Poe stories into it. It's usually, you know, titled after one of Edgar Allan Poe's stories. It has lots of different elements in it. You know, I remember, what was the name of the one? Was it The Tomb of Ligeia, I think? You know, definitely had that storyline in there. Woman that died, but kind of comes back through another woman kind of thing. But it threw things in there like the black cat. The woman's consciousness was in a cat for a while. And so they had some of that in there. What was the other movie that I watched? Pit and the Pendulum was an interesting show. You know, and again, it had stuff from the story in it, but it took its own liberties. And so this year, I got The Mask of the Red Death. And it was another, you know, Vincent Price is often the star of these Roger Corman, Edgar Allan Poe stories. And, he is for this one as well. And so we have Mask of the Red Death. But this was actually a double feature. It was Mask of the Red Death and The Premature Burial. The Premature Burial I read for this podcast way back a long time ago. I can put the links in the show notes to that. So I'll talk about The Premature Burial. I thought that was the best of these two movies. It might be one of the better Roger Corman adaptations. I don't remember the actor's name that's the lead actor. It was interesting. I watched a little bit of the commentary. I guess it was extra content on the DVD, which had Roger Corman and other people talking about the movie. This was The Premature Burial was Roger Corman kind of going out on his own to do. I can't remember the circumstances, but the name of the film company that he was with didn't want to do the movie or didn't want to work with Roger Corman anymore or something like that. And so he decided to go out on his own and do it on his own. But the studio that did his other movies had the rights to Vincent Price as an actor, and that disallowed him from using Vincent Price in The Premature Burial. And so I can't remember the name of the gentleman. I'll put it in the show notes. If you notice, I usually have a fact checker section on the blog that clears up any mistakes that I made while recording the podcast, because of course I don't have the internet. I don't have any materials other than a list of movies. I'm driving, so I can't read things. But anyway, I thought The Premature Burial was a pretty good show. You know, I was interested to see how they went with it, because there's really not a lot to go from in the movie. Sorry, in the story. You know, it's a first-person narration story, and it just talks a lot about the history of premature burials and things that have happened in real life, well, in history, and things that this person has heard of. And then he has this great fear, and he goes to great lengths to prevent premature burial. Has a tomb built with all these escapes and stuff like that. He's totally worried about it, and at the end he wakes up, he goes away from his house, and he wakes up and he thinks that he's in a coffin buried alive. It turns out he's on a boat, I think, in a little cabin, you know, sleeping berth or whatever, that feels like it's a coffin. He has these episodes of catalepsy, which I think is an actual thing, where people go into a catatonic state where it appears that they're dead, and often that would happen and people would actually get buried alive. And so, you know, that's the main point of the whole story, is to build up this fear, or to explain this fear that this person has and put him in a situation where he's dealing. And then in the end, he's like, oh, you know what? It was all my head, just like they said, kind of thing. I'm not worried about that anymore. So I was interested to see, based on that, you know, how you're going to make a movie with a, you know, a plot and a, you know, storyline to follow, not just listening to somebody describe how they're scared of being buried alive and explaining the history of it. So they did a pretty good job. It starts out, I think, where a woman comes to a house to talk to her fiancé, who's called off the marriage, and it's a guy that, and he tells her the reason he can't bear to marry her is because he wants to save her from dealing with him, because he does have this great fear of being buried alive, and that he's a victim of catalepsy, and he knows, he believes in his mind that is how his father died, was from catalepsy and being entombed too early, and has visions, or thought he heard screaming and stuff coming from the tomb. And she convinces him to get married anyway, that he loves her. Oh, it starts out when they're digging up a grave, I think, and they find claw marks on the grave. That's how the beginning of it starts. And there's these grave diggers that show up throughout the movie. It's just, I don't know, it's just, I thought it caught a really good mood for the show. Anyway, it shows that he continues to have this fear, and he does go through great lengths and builds this tomb with all these escape plans, and there's even poison in there in case he can't get out, so he'll just kill himself with poison or whatever. But his wife is trying to get him to not worry about that and to get rid of it, and she has a psychologist friend who comes and talks to him and tries to talk sense into him. And her father shows up a couple times, and what kind of a man is this, kind of thing, or whatever. And so it's going on and on, and then I'm going to have to play the song when I do this episode. But there's a song that the grave digger, one of the grave diggers, is whistling while at the beginning of the movie, while he's digging the grave, he's whistling this song at their wedding night. And they have a bunch of people over at his mansion to celebrate the wedding or whatever. And his wife goes over and starts to play the piano for people. And everybody's like, oh, great. She starts playing that same song. And it's a common song. I know you've heard it. And it just drives him crazy. And he gets angry at her and tells her to stop. And bursts out of the room. And people are like, what's going on? You know, as he's worried about all these things. And there's one point where his mansion is out on these moors. So it's always foggy. It's always, you know, it's out on the moors, right? That's where his tomb is, at this special super-duper multi-escape route tomb is. It's where, you know, they were digging up the grave and all these things. And so, you know, there's this scene where he's out, him and his wife are out in the swamp. And I think it's after she's convinced him to destroy and burn the tomb down. Which my thought was, dude, if this guy has fears and he's already built the thing, just let him have it. Who cares, you know? And so I was thinking, man, you know, if it makes him feel better, let him keep it. But she was convinced that he needed to get rid of it. But anyway, there's this scene where he starts to hear the whistling. He starts to hear the song. And he has to find it. And he runs away from her. And she's chasing him through the moors. And he's trying to find it. He keeps hearing it. And it's getting louder and faster and all these different things. And he's just running, you know, I thought it was filmed very well. And then he sees one of the grave diggers and he faints and the scene kind of cuts away and he's back in his bed and they found him and all this stuff. And so he had this terrible vision. They said, no, there was nobody on the moor. There was no whistling. I didn't hear anything and that kind of thing. So but he does end up at some point where it appears that he's dead. He just falls over. It appears that he's dead and he's not. He kind of wakes up. And you can hear him hear what he's thinking. He's like, no, I'm right here. No, I'm not dead. And they call her dad in. He's a doctor. And they call her dad in to give him a checkup and to see if he's dead. Because the psychiatrist guys kind of started to believe him, you know. And he's like, no, we have to make sure. We can't just assume that he's dead. We have to get a doctor. And so they call her dad in. He says, yeah, he's dead, you know. But they were so quick to call him dead and to get him buried. I'm like, something's not right here. They know how scared he was of this. They should be doing better to honor him, you know, and his fears and these things. And so they go put him in the grave, right? There's a window in the coffin for some reason. He's watching them throw the dirt down the thing. You can hear his mind. And he's like, no, I'm right here. No, don't do this. No, you know, and it does kind of, you're kind of like, oh my gosh, he's getting buried alive kind of thing, you know, and I mean, that doesn't scare you really, but you know, it's pretty effective in the way that it gives this. And again, anything that I'm talking about is going to be a spoiler. So I'm pretty much describing everything to you. So they bury him. Then they go back to the mansion and then the wife goes to visit the psychiatrist guy. She kind of starts to hit on him. And it's like she's getting over her husband really fast. He just died, you know, and then she's kind of hitting on him and stuff. I guess they knew each other when they were younger and everything. And it just doesn't feel right. You know, something's not right. And then the grave diggers go back to his grave and start to dig him up. And I can't remember why, but they said, oh, the old man, they buried him with something that he wanted or something like that. So they're digging him up, and as soon as they open the coffin, he comes out because he's alive, right? And he kills him, and he learns that it was his father-in-law that was arranged all this. You know, the whistling and the moors and all this stuff was done. You know, the gravediggers worked for him, and a lot of this was done to, you know, I guess to take advantage of this fear that he had, and to drive him mad and to drive him to be dead. And the wife was in on it. You know, I didn't quite buy that for a little bit, but you know, then I thought back of how she was hitting on the psychiatrist guy. So yeah, her father and her were in it. That's why she convinced him to get married and all this stuff. So it kind of comes back. He kills the father. I think he electrocutes him or whatever. And then they're figuring things out. He said, I'll prove it to you. Yeah, I think this is when how he died, is that he said he would prove it. I'll prove it to you. I'll prove that my father was alive in his tomb, because they were going to go in the tomb and got the keys and everything. And there was something about the keys that we had seen somebody go in earlier. Anyway, so as soon as he opens the door, his dead father, his father's dead body, falls out right on top of him. And I think that sends him into, and that's the reason he dies, or goes, has catalepsy or whatever. I can't remember if the wife survives, or he's about to kill the lady and somebody shoots him or something like that. I can't remember exactly how it ends. So you're going to have to watch it yourself to find that out if you want to. But anyway, I thought it was pretty good. I was like, wow, this is maybe one of the best Roger Corman, Edgar Allan Poe movies that I've watched. And I wasn't thinking that I wouldn't enjoy it as much. I thought, oh, I'll like The Mask of the Red Death better. Which brings me to that movie. And that movie, I didn't really like very much. It was really, I guess, it had been a while since I've read The Mask of the Red Death, and it's never really been one of my favorite stories. So yeah, The Mask of the Red Death, this one does star Vincent Price, as I said, but I didn't like it as much. It was a lot darker than I thought, and of course, you know, Edgar Allan Poe, Halloween, you know, scary movie, dark. Of course, it's going to be dark. This one seemed darker than most, and I don't remember the story being as dark. I mean, obviously it was dark in a way, but just this seemed very, I don't know, it seemed like a departure for me, but I'm going to have to go back and read The Mask of the Red Death. And like I said, it's not one of my favorite stories anyway, but it's Prince Prospero, and he has this masquerade party, and there's this Red Death, which is a fictional plague. You know, much like the Black Plague, right? But this is the Red Death. So, you know, so it's sweeping the country. People are dying throughout the land. And he has this masquerade party with a bunch of other nobles. And that's kind of what the story is, right? There's not much plot to it other than one of the visitors that comes to this masquerade is Death himself. He visits Prospero. Dies. I think that's the basic, you know, thing about the story, right? There's not a lot to it other than that. But anyway, so this movie with Vincent Price as Prince Prospero, and it starts out pretty good. It shows him going to a village and just being evil and mean to the peasants, you know, kills somebody just so that he can take the girlfriend or wife or whatever, and he takes a couple people prisoners, and but then they discover this old lady who's dying of the Red Death, and so they run back to the castle to so that they aren't exposed to the Red Death. Another cool thing about this is it starts out with Red Death as a character, and he's just sitting by a tree. You know, it's again like in this dark forest on the moors kind of thing. I don't know if it's on the moors, but it's kind of that same thing, you know, dark woods, Red Death. This guy dressed in all red is sitting there talking, ends up talking to somebody that goes by. It's kind of, I'm going to have to go back and listen to what he says, because it's just kind of one of those things, you know, when you have Death talking, it's kind of pithy and poignant, and you can read it a lot of different ways. And I kind of like that stuff. And so that was kind of neat to have him as a character kind of starting out the story. But then it goes right into the Prince Prospero stuff. And I don't remember this woman who he brings back from the village. I think that's all Roger Corman. I think it's all for the movie. I don't think that's part of the book or the story. I could be wrong. I might have bad memory. But anyway, and it's just kind of him kind of trying to corrupt her. He has these parties at the palace or castle or whatever with all these nobles, and I think this one scene is from the movie where he goes around and he says, oh, you're like a pig, be a pig. And then the guy starts getting on the ground and snorting around and rummaging up like a pig, and somebody else is laughing at that guy and he says, oh, you think that's funny, huh? Get down and be a seal or you know, I don't think the seal was one of them, but he makes all these people just because he's the prince and he has the power. You know, and everybody laughs and thinks it's all funny. I think that part of that is from the story, but yeah. And it's just, this woman is appalled that he would abuse his power in such a way and all this stuff. But I think eventually she agrees. But underlying all this, there's this, he comes right out and says that he serves the Lord Satan, you know? So, I mean, him and this other woman, I think it might be his sister. Maybe it's just another lover or something like that. But anyway, you know, they've given themselves over to Satan and they're out and out Satan worshipers and doing these rituals and stuff. And so he doesn't care about people. And you know, he doesn't think there's nothing like a moral compass or any ideals or anything that would prevent him from being terrible to people. And yes, I know there's many people that don't have faith that are nice to people and don't want to be evil. But no, he's out and out worshiping Satan. At first I thought, well, that's bold. You know, that's kind of cool. And I could see Rich Outfield saying, oh, yeah, that's pretty cool. Not that he's a Satan worshiper. But, you know, he just always makes the jokes about, you know, the Dark One or whatever. And so I could see Rich saying, wow, that's pretty cool. And I at first I thought, oh, that's pretty bold, you know, that they would do. But the more he went into it, the darker it got. I was like, oh, I don't know if I like this very much. This really doesn't make me feel good. You know, it's not like a happy scared or like a, ooh, this is cool. Or they're talking about death. And it, over time, I really started not to like it. Really started to not be comfortable with all the stuff that was going on. Even when they threw in Hop Frog. Hop Frog is a different story. And I've played it on the podcast. I'll put it in the show notes. Big Anklevich was Hop Frog for that. And did a great job. And I did that a long time ago as well. But anyway, Hop Frog is this little midget guy that serves the king, you know, for his pleasure and entertainment. And the king has his court of people, and it wasn't Prince Prospero. You know, these two stories are not mixed, but Roger Corman put them together into one. And I guess it kind of makes sense that they could go together because it's in Hop Frog, in the story, there's a masquerade ball, and Hop Frog takes out his revenge on the king at the masquerade ball and all of his court. But in the movie, he just takes out his revenge on one of the other guests that's a friend of Prince Prospero. And it follows the same thing where there was this little dancer. She was his, well, in the book, in the story, I think it would be his girlfriend or his wife. And I can't remember her name. Or anyway, she accidentally bumps into the king and makes him spill his wine. And he slaps her, knocks her, you know, hits her really hard, knocks her down. And that's when Hop Frog starts planning his revenge to kill the king and his court because they all laugh. But in the movie, again, it was just this one guy that the same thing happened. You know, she spilled his wine, and he was just delightful. And she was really young. This is kind of some of the unsettling stuff is, you know, him and this other noble and Prince Prospero were sitting there talking, and he's like, oh, you want her, don't you? You want to add her to your collection or something like that. But she was a very young girl, like really young. And I didn't like that. I don't like that, you know. And of course, you know, Prince Prospero, it's like, who cares? It's no big deal. I serve Satan. Kind of stuff. And so I don't know. There's things about it that I really didn't like. I thought it was a little bit too dark, too sketchy, especially with that guy lusting after this little girl. You know, I think the actress in the movie was a very young girl, but the way that they talked about her, it was that she was older. Like she was a young, like a tiny, you know, like a woman. But no, the actress that played was not a woman, it was a little girl. And so, yeah, I didn't feel right about that. I didn't like that. And just the more Satan worshiping stuff, they just kept going back to that. care for that too much. I was talking about Hop Frog, where we see it unfold. He tricks the guy. He ends up killing the guy at the masquerade ball, similar to how he did the king in his court. And I'll let you listen to Hop Frog or read Hop Frog on your own to get all the details of that. But I thought I would like that because I like the story. I like how it's told. And I like Hop Frog's perspective and just the way Edgar Allan Poe wrote that. I like that story. But when I saw it on the movie and the guy dies and everybody laughs and go on with the party and Prince Prospero's like, oh, well, he was a fine friend, but that's about... I didn't like it. You know, I started to question, should I really like Edgar Allan Poe? Is this the kind of stuff I like? It just, I don't know if it was because it was visual and I saw it happen. You know, in the book, or in the story, I keep saying book, in the Edgar Allan Poe story, Hop Frog, everybody doesn't just laugh and go on and party. I mean, it's the end of the movie. He escapes and takes the love of his life after he's killed the king in his court and leaves. And it's a triumphant moment for Hop Frog, and it's not meant to be laughed at and taken lightly. I mean, it's a very drastic thing that he did. You know, I don't think anybody at that party, that masquerade in the Hop Frog story, was laughing about it. I think, you know, they were horrified by what was going on. I can't remember if it says that they were, but I just imagine that they would be. And Hop Frog has his revenge kind of thing. But the way it was portrayed in the movie, I really, really didn't like it. I didn't like a lot of the things, the way it was done. It was just very evil. Just, I don't know. Maybe I'm losing my edge. Maybe I'm getting soft. I don't know. And I'm tempted to go back and read The Mask of the Red Death, but I don't know if I will. Because, like I said, it's not one of my favorites. But I thought the movie might be different. And it was, but... Anyway, that's probably enough about that. Oh, I guess one of the things, and I don't think this was in the book, but it was really weird. There was this series of rooms that were in the palace, and they were all a different color. Like, the first room was, like, stark yellow. Everything in the room, the walls, the ceiling, the furniture, the floor, everything was yellow. And then you go to another room, and there's a white room, and a purple room, and a blue room, and a... Well, there's probably a green room and a red room. Or maybe there wasn't a red room because he had a thing about red. He didn't like red because of the Red Death, I guess. I don't know. But then it ended up in the black room, and that was where they did their Satan worshiping stuff. And I don't know. It just it was really strange. But I have a couple other movies that I watched this October. And the kids didn't watch all of these with me, and I really didn't like... Maybe that was part of it, too, was when we were watching Mask of the Death, my kids came in and started watching it with me, and I just didn't like them seeing what I was watching. But I didn't like what I was watching, a lot of it, either. Maybe I should have turned it off, but with them there, I don't know, I didn't like it. For the Red Death, I did like Premature Burial, so that's one thumbs up, one thumbs down so far on these movies. So what else did we get? I also got a double feature of the classic Frankenstein and then The Bride of Frankenstein, the sequel. And this was back from the 1940s, you know, the first adaptation, Universal Monsters movies of Frankenstein. And I've never sat down and watched it. I've seen, you know, It's Alive 1,000 times, and I've seen the end, you know, where he gets burned on the windmill many times, but I've never sat down and watched the entire movie of Frankenstein, the old one, the old black and white one. And so I watched it. It was pretty good. The kids liked it too. You know, at first they were like, oh, what's this? They got into it and they kind of liked it. The part where, and I'm not gonna, I mean, come on, this is 1940s. If you haven't watched Frankenstein, which I hadn't watched the whole thing, but if you want to avoid spoilers on an old black and white movie. And so there's this part where he leaves the castle and he's out in the public and he comes across this little girl who's playing by the water, playing by a river or a lake. And she's taking off the top of flowers and throwing them in the water. And he kind of comes up, and she's a little scared of him at first, but then she plays with him. And they're just playing together. They're playing with the flowers and throwing them in the water. And he says something like, "You're a pretty flower." And he picks the little girl up and throws her in the water. She can't swim, and she's drowning. And he's, like, not getting it, that he's killed her. And then I think he does, and he kind of runs away ashamed. I never knew that was in that movie. And my kids were like, "What? He just threw her in there and killed her?" And I said, "Well, he didn't know. He's simple. You know, he thought she was a flower, and it was fun to throw her in the water." And they're kind of like, "Whoa, that's really wacky." And, like, anyway, my youngest son, who's kind of has that same sensibility as I do, is to, you know, take these things more in stride. But he just couldn't get over that. He talked about that for several days. He goes, "Yeah," then he just throws her in the water. So, and then we watched, right the same night, I think, we watched The Bride of Frankenstein, because they're pretty short movies, too. And, you know, again, I had never seen The Bride of Frankenstein. I knew what she looked like, but I'd never seen the movie. And it's interesting, right? Because Frankenstein dies at the end of the first movie. And, you know, we talk about blockbusters and sequels and stuff, but, I mean, these sequels were happening way back when. And, of course, I knew there were several Frankenstein movies and several Wolfman movies and Dracula movies and stuff, but I had never sat down and watched them. And so it was interesting to see, you know, Frankenstein died at the end of the first movie. He was burned up in the windmill. So we thought. The next movie opens up with, you know, the famous trio, and now I can't remember all their names, but Mary Shelley, who wrote Frankenstein. I know there's lots of theories that she didn't, that her brother did or whatever. I think she did. And so it was Mary Shelley, Lord Byron, and some other famous author that I can't think of right now. And they would meet and talk about stuff, and, you know, like writers do. It's kind of a writer's retreat kind of thing. And they would tell each other the things that they were thinking of. And this is real. This is actual stuff that had happened. I mean, it's historically accurate that they would meet together and they would tell each other their stories. And this is where Mary Shelley first described her idea for writing Frankenstein, you know, to bring somebody back from the dead, or to create something and bring life into it out of dead body parts and stuff. I mean, it was a very horrific thing. Now we take it for granted, but at the time that it was written, it was a very, you know, novel idea, a very horrific thing to think about. Anyway, so it starts out with the author, with Mary Shelley and Lord Byron and the other guy in this, you know, house, talking about stuff and talking about their stories. And they, you know, they end up talking about the Frankenstein and how it ended. And she says, "Well, actually, I have another story." And so under the windmill, there was a well, and Frankenstein had gotten down into the well, into the water, and had survived the burning windmill. So that's how he survived. So it's one of those sequels, you know. It's like Jason. Well, Jason was killed in the first movie. No, he wasn't. He's back. And he's back again and again and again. And so now Frankenstein's back. Or Frankenstein's monster, I should say. Dr. Frankenstein. And, you know, he's in the movie too. I think his wife is different. A lot of things changed as far as Dr. Frankenstein goes. And like I said, his wife is different. There's different people around him. And I think the house that he lives in is different as well. The castle is the same, but the house that he lives in is different, I think. It didn't seem right. It didn't seem quite the same. Anyway, he ends up collaborating with this other person, and he realizes the mistake of what he did, but then this other person talks him into doing it again. And then the monster ends up finding Frankenstein and says he wants a wife, demands that Frankenstein, you know, creates life again and brings life to woman for him. And that is accurate to the book. He did, you know, Frankenstein's monster did demand to have a mate. The thing I realized about Frankenstein when I read the book was that he was very intelligent, the monster was. He was brutish and strong and awkward, but he spoke very well. He wasn't the grunting, groaning, walking stiffly monster that, you know, the stereotypical
Frankenstein's monster that we're so used to.
It was different. So that was an interesting thing to watch the sequel. And there was, the discs showed it, but of course you would have had to have other discs to watch the other movies. But I think there was The Son of Frankenstein, The House of Frankenstein, and there was one other movie that was on that. And I don't know if that's all the Frankenstein movies. I know, you know, there's the Abbott and Costello one that I've only seen parts of as well. So maybe next year I'll get Abbott and Costello. It's Frankenstein or the Wolfman. But I thought maybe next year we'll do the Wolfman. Then the next, you know, we'll do Dracula the next year or something. And just watch some of these classic horror movies. Speaking of classic, we also got the 1925 silent movie version of Phantom of the Opera. Because I had never seen that. I'd seen the movie that they made of the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical of the Phantom of the Opera. And you can find the radio version of Phantom of the Opera here on the podcast. I'll put that in the show notes. So I knew the story of the Phantom of the Opera, but I had never seen that. You know, I had often seen what the Phantom looked like in there, but I never watched the movie. And I thought, I didn't realize it was a silent movie. I've made my kids watch a couple silent movies. They typically have enjoyed them. The Man Who Laughs is a silent movie from the same time frame, I guess, the 1920s or 30s. And it's supposedly who the Joker, you know, Batman's the Joker, was based on, or at least the image of his face, because he does, in The Man Who Laughs, it was a man whose face was, you know, fixed into this smiling face, and it was kind of gruesome or looking or whatever, different, you know, very unsettling if you ran across this guy. So anyway, it's a different movie altogether. But so we had watched that at least 3 years ago. And so that was their first exposure to a silent movie. You know, a lot of times they're, oh, it's black and white, I don't want to watch it. But the silent movie was kind of interesting for them. I did also get Metropolis, which is, you know, the famous Metropolis silent movie with all of the imagery and stuff. And that one, I didn't really catch their interest too much. They watched part of it. I have to admit, I didn't care for that one as much either. I mean, I know it's iconic, and I know, you know, there's some sequences in there, and the imagery of you know, society and all these things are pretty impressive and pretty stunning. But the plot of the movie, it is a lot more plodding along, I guess you could say. It just doesn't grab you and catch you as much as the Man Who Laughs did. If you appreciate the imagery and you appreciate the satire and the just, you know, the amazing set pieces and things like that, I appreciated it a little bit on that level, which got me through watching the movie. But the kids, you know, that's kind of beyond them at this point, which I don't blame them. I mean, I don't know if I would have sat through it when I was a kid. Anyway, that's not what I was going to talk about, but I guess it's all part of the Netflix queue. I think I watched that on Netflix. I got rented those from Netflix. But anyway, so we were talking about the Phantom of the Opera. And it was, you know, it's, it's, I think, one of the oldest movies. Yeah, it's barely preserved. You know, it's pretty hard and grainy in a lot of spots. And it's not even black and white, right? It's like the sepia. Or it's kind of that brownish black and white color. But it's I don't know, there's something about watching a silent movie that's kind of fun every once in a while. It's just a different experience watching a silent movie. You know, you watch them and then you see the words come up. It's kind of neat. And I liked this version of Phantom of the Opera. It was a little bit longer. But I love the acting because, you know, they have to act with their eyes and their actions. And a lot of times it's so exaggerated, you know. And there's not a lot of subtlety in silent movies. It's just, I don't know, I find a lot of that pretty fascinating to watch that and to realize, you know, there was a time you couldn't hear anything when you're watching a movie and it's the piano playing the whole time. And it's just cool. It's kind of neat. And I enjoyed it. I enjoyed Phantom of the Opera. He is pretty ghoulish looking. His mask, I thought, was not the best. You know, the one that we're used to from the musical, you know, it's just part of his face is covered. And other, but you can see kind of where he used to be handsome. Not this one. The mask looks ugly and his face looks weird. And it is pretty startling. I thought they did a really good job with the Phantom of the Opera. The plot's the same. You know, he kind of runs this opera house and everybody knows him as the Phantom. And he doesn't run it, but he definitely has influence on the owners and he has stipulations. You know, box 5 is always for the Phantom. And it's a cool story. And I enjoy the musical and I enjoyed this. Yeah, so that was good too. So we got, 5 movies this year and watched them. I was surprised I had the time. But I think, Phantom Menace. Ha! I'm combining things. I think we watched The Premature Burial and The Mask of the Red Death on Halloween. I know Premature Burial for sure. Yeah, I think we watched them on the same night. And we might have watched Phantom of the Opera after Halloween. Anyway, we got all those movies. And then I forgot to check the queue. And I forgot to, you know, change what movie was coming next. And I don't know if you've ever heard of the movie. It was 70s, right? Early 70s movie. TV show called The Night Stalker, about this reporter. And he goes out and he sees all these, you know, monster type things, horror kind of things. He tries to report on it. Whatever. It's kind of a neat little show. And I think it only lasted like a season or something like that. But anyway, so I had put that on my queue a long time ago for the DVD sets of The Night Stalker. There was two discs. But when I got the email saying that it was coming, I'm like, no, I'm not in the mood for that. You know, I'll have to return those as soon as we get them. And we did. But when they came, I realized, oh, this must be like a reboot, or they must have done a Night Stalker series later, like in the 90s or something, because it wasn't the same. It wasn't Kolchak, or it might have been Kolchak, but it was a totally different version. And so, anyway, I thought that was interesting. So there you go. There's my October movie picks for this year for my family. Several that I enjoyed, one that I particularly did not. It's unfortunate because it's Edgar Allan Poe and I'm a proponent of his. I guess it didn't work for me here. Anyways, that has been the Netflix queue for this time around. I guess we'll kind of wait around and see what else is strewn along the path next time. Bye-bye.
The Journey Into podcast is produced under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives license. You can't change it, you can't sell it, and you have to let people know that it originally came from me.